Yeah, slow and easy. The Invincible. The sky was half filled with white, fleecy clouds, their undersides gray with the threat of rain. A 20-knot wind was blowing from the southwest, and a 6-foot sea was running, its dark waves streaked with whitecaps. Ryan saw the Bristol and Fife holding station to windward. Their captains, no doubt, were muttering a few choice words at this disposition. The American escorts, which had been detached the previous day, were now sailing to rendezvous with the USS New Jersey. White was talking into the phone again.
"Commander, I want to know the instant we get a radar return from the target area. Train every set aboard onto that patch of ocean. I also want to know of any, repeat, any sonar signals from that area."
"That is correct. Depth of target? Very well. Recall the second helicopter. I want both on station to windward."
They had agreed that the best method of passing the message would be to use a blinker light. Only someone placed in the direct line of sight would be able to read the signal. Hunter moved to the light, holding a sheet of paper Ryan had given him. The yeoman and signalman, normally stationed here, were gone. The Red October.
30 meters, Comrade Captain, Borodin reported.
The battle watch was set in the control center.
"Periscope," Ramius said calmly.
The oiled metal tube hissed upward on hydraulic pressure. The captain handed his cap to the junior officer of the watch as he bent to look into the eyepiece.
"So, we have here 3 Imperialist ships. HMS Invincible. Such a name for a ship," he scoffed for his audience. "2 escorts, Bristol and a county-class cruiser."
The Invincible.
"Periscope, starboard bow," the speaker announced.
"I see it." Barclay's hand shot out to point.
"There it is."
Ryan strained to find it.
"I got it."
It was like a small broomstick sitting vertically in the water about a mile away. As the waves rolled past, the bottommost visible part of the periscope flared out.
"Hunter," White said quietly.
To Ryan's left, the captain began jerking his hand on the lever that controlled the light shutters. The Red October. Ramius didn't see it at first. He was making a complete circle of the horizon, checking for any other ships or aircraft. When he finished the circuit, the flashing light caught his eye. Quickly, he tried to interpret the signal. It took him a moment to realize it was pointed right at him.
AAA, AAA, AAA.
Red October, can you read this? Can you read this? Please ping us one time on active sonar if you can read this. Please ping us one time on active sonar if you can read this. AAA, AAA, AAA. Red October, Red October, can you read this? Can you read this? The message kept repeating. The signal was jerky and awkward. Ramius didn't notice this. He translated the English signal in his head, at first thinking it was a signal to the American submarine. His knuckles went white on the periscope hand grips as he translated the message in his mind.
"Borodin," he said, finally, after reading the message a fourth time. "We set up a practice firing solution on Invincible. Damn, the periscope rangefinder is sticking. A single ping, comrade. Just one, for range."
Ping!
The Invincible.
"One ping from the contact area, sir. Sound Soviet," the speaker reported.
White lifted his phone.
"Thank you. Keep us informed."
He set it back down.
"Well, gentlemen?"
"He did it,"
Ryan sang out.
"Send the rest, for Christ's sake."
"At once."
Hunter grinned like a madman.
"Red October, Red October, your whole fleet is chasing after you. Your whole fleet is chasing after you. Your path is blocked by numerous vessels. Numerous attack submarines are waiting to attack you. Repeat, numerous attack submarines are waiting to attack you. Proceed to rendezvous 33 North, 75 West. We have ships there waiting for you. Repeat, proceed to rendezvous 33 North, 75 West. We have ships there waiting for you. If you understand and agree, please ping us again one time."
The Red October.
"Distance to target, Borodin,"
Ramius asked, wishing he had more time as the message was repeated again and again.
2,000 meters, comrade captain. A nice fat target for us if we—
The Starpalm's voice trailed off as he saw the commander's face.
They know our name, Ramius was thinking. They know our name. How can this be? They knew where to find us, exactly. How? What can the Americans have? How long has the Los Angeles been tracing us? Decide. You must decide.
Comrade, one more ping on the target. Just one.
The Invincible.
One more ping, Admiral.
Thank you. White looked at Ryan.
Well, Jack, it would seem that your intelligence estimate was indeed correct.
Jolly good.
Jolly good, my ass, my Lord Earl, I was right, son of a bitch!
Ryan's hands flew up in the air, his seasickness forgotten. He calmed down. The occasion called for more decorum.
Excuse me, Admiral, we have some things to do.
The Dallas. Whole fleet is chasing after you. Proceed to 33 north, 75 west. What the hell was going on? Mancuso wondered, catching the end of the second signal.
Khan's sonar getting hull-popping noises from the target. His depth is changing. Engine noise increasing.
Down scope. Mancuso lifted the phone. Very well, sonar. Anything else, Jones?
No, sir. The helicopters are gone, and there aren't any emissions from the surface ships.
What gives, sir?
Beats me.
Mancuso shook his head as Mannion brought the Dallas back in pursuit of the Red October. What the hell was happening here? The captain wondered. Why was a Brit carrier signaling to a Russian submarine? And why were they sending her to a rendezvous off the Carolinas? Whose subs were blocking her path? It couldn't be. No way. It just couldn't be. The Invincible. Ryan was in the Invincible's communications room. Magi to Olympus, he typed into the special encoding device the CIA had sent out with him. Played my mandolin today. Sounded pretty good. I'm planning a little concert at the usual place. Expect good critical reviews. Awaiting instructions. Ryan had laughed before at the code words he was supposed to use for this. He was laughing now. For a different reason. The White House.
So, Pelt observed, Ryan expects the mission will be successful. Everything's going according to plan, but he didn't use the code group for certain success.
The president leaned back comfortably. He's honest. Things can always go wrong. You have to admit, though, things do look good.
This plan the chiefs came up with is crazy, sir.
Perhaps. But you've been trying to poke a hole in it for several days now, and you haven't succeeded. The pieces will all fall in place shortly. The president was being clever, Pelt saw. The man liked being clever.
The Invincible. Olympus to Magi. I like old-fashioned mandolin music.
Concert approved, the message said.
Ryan sat back comfortably, sipping at his brandy.
Well, that's good. I wonder what the next part of the plan is.
I expect that Washington will let us know. For the moment, Admiral White said, we'll have to move back west to interpose ourselves between October and the Soviet fleet.
The Avalon. Lieutenant Ames surveyed the scene through the tiny port on the Avalon's bow. The Alpha lay on her port side. She had obviously hit stern first, and hard. One blade was snapped off the propeller, and the lower rudder fin was smashed. The whole stern might have been knocked off true. It was hard to tell in the low visibility.
Moving forward slowly, he said, adjusting the controls.
Behind him, an ensign and a senior petty officer were monitoring instruments and preparing to deploy the manipulator arm, attached before they sailed, which carried a television camera and floodlights. These gave them a slightly wider field of view than the navigation ports permitted. The DSRV crept forward at 1 knot. Visibility was under 20 yards, despite the million candles of illumination from the bow lights. The seafloor at this point was a treacherous slope of alluvial silt dotted with boulders.
It appeared that the only thing that had prevented the Alpha from sliding farther down was her sail, driven like a wedge into the bottom.
"Holy God!" the petty officer saw at first. There was a crack in the Alpha's hull. Or was there?
"Reactor accident," Ames said, his voice detached and clinical. "Something burned through the hull."
"Lord, and that's titanium. Burned right through from the inside out. There's another one. Two burn-throughs. This one's bigger. Looks like a good yard across. No mystery what killed her, guys. That's two compartments open to the sea."
Ames looked over to the depth gauge. 1,880 feet.
"Getting all this on tape?"
"Aye, skipper,"
the electrician first class answered.
"Crummy way to die. Poor bastards."
"Yeah, depending on what they were up to." Ames maneuvered the Avalon around the Alpha's bow, working the directional propeller carefully and adjusting trim to cruise down the other side. Actually, the top of the dead sub.
"See any evidence of a hull fracture?"
"No," the ensign answered. "Just the two burn-throughs. I wonder what went wrong."
"A for real China syndrome. It finally happened to somebody."
Ames shook his head. If there was anything the Navy preached about reactors, it was safety. "Get the transducer against the hull. We'll see if anybody's alive in there."
"Aye."
The electrician worked the Waldo controls, as Ames tried to keep the Avalon dead still. Neither task was easy. The DSRV was hovering, nearly resting on the sail. If there were survivors, they had to be in the control room or forward. There could be no life aft.
"Okay, I got contact."
All three men listened intently, hoping for something. Their job was search and rescue, and as submariners themselves, they took it seriously.
"Maybe they're asleep."
The ensign switched on the locator sonar. The high-frequency waves resonated through both vessels. It was a sound fit to wake the dead, but there was no response. The air supply in the Politovsky had run out a day before.
"That's that," Ames said quietly.
He maneuvered upward as the electrician rigged in the manipulator arm, looking for a spot to drop a sonar transponder. They would be back again when the topside weather was better. The Navy would not pass up this chance to inspect an Alpha, and the Glomar Explorer was sitting unused somewhere on the west coast. Would she be activated? Ames would not bet against that.
"Avalon, Avalon, this is Scamp." The voice on the Gertrude was distorted but readable. "Return at once. Acknowledge."
"Scamp, this is Avalon. On the way."
The Scamp had just received an ELF message and gone briefly to periscope depth for a flash operational order. "Proceed at best speed to 33 north, 75 west. The message didn't say why. CIA headquarters.
"Cardinal is still with us," Moore told Ritter.
"Well, thank God for that,"
Ritter sat down.
"There's a signal en route. This time he didn't try to kill himself getting it to us. Maybe being in the hospital scared him a little. I'm extending another offer to extract him."
"Again?"
"Bob, we have to make the offer."
"I know. I had one sent myself a few years back, you know. The old bastard just doesn't want to quit. You know how it goes. Some people thrive on the action. Or maybe he hasn't worked out his rage yet. I just got a call from Senator Donaldson."
Donaldson was the chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence.
"Oh?" "He wants to know what we know about what's going on. He doesn't buy the cover story about a rescue mission, and thinks we know something different."
Judge Moore leaned back.
"I wonder who planted that idea in his head."
"Yeah, I have a little idea we might try. I think it's time, and this is a dandy opportunity."
The two senior executives discussed this for an hour. Before Ritter left for the Hill, they cleared it with the President. Washington, D.C. Donaldson kept Ritter waiting in his outer office for 15 minutes while he read the paper. He wanted Ritter to know his place. Some of the DDO's remarks about leaks from the Hill had touched a sore spot with the senator from Connecticut,
and it was important for appointed and civil service officials to understand the difference between themselves and the elected representatives of the people.
"Sorry to keep you waiting, Mr. Ritter." Donaldson did not rise, nor did he offer to shake hands.
"Quite all right, sir. Took the chance to read a magazine. Don't get to do that much, what with the schedule I work."
They fenced with each other for the first moment.
So, what are the Soviets up to?
"Senator, before I address that subject, I must say this. I had to clear this meeting with the President. This information is for you alone. No one else may hear it, sir. No one. That comes from the White House."
"There are other men on my committee, Mr. Ritter."
"Sir, if I do not have your word as a gentleman," Ritter added with a smile, "I will not reveal this information. Those are my orders. I work for the executive branch, Senator. I take my orders from the President."
Ritter hoped his recording device was getting all of this.
"Agreed,"
Donaldson said reluctantly. He was angry because of the foolish restrictions, but pleased that he was getting to hear this.
"Go on."
"Frankly, sir, we are not sure exactly what's going on," Ritter said.
"Oh, so you've sworn me to secrecy so that I can't tell anyone that, again, the CIA doesn't know what the hell is going on?"
"I said we don't know exactly what's happening. We do know a few things. Our information comes mainly from the Israelis and some from the French. From both channels, we have learned that something has gone very wrong with the Soviet Navy."
"I gathered that. They've lost a sub."
"At least one. But that's not what's going on. Someone, we think, has played a trick on the Operations Directorate of the Soviet Northern Fleet. I can't say for sure, but I think it was the Poles."
"Why the Poles?"
"I don't know for sure that it is, but both the French and the Israelis are well connected with the Poles, and the Poles have a long-standing beef with the Soviets. I do know, at least I think I know, that whatever this is did not come from a Western intelligence agency."
"So, what's happening?" Donaldson demanded.
"Our best guess is that someone has committed at least one forgery, possibly as many as three, all aimed at raising hell in the Soviet Navy. But whatever it was, it's gotten far out of hand. A lot of people are working hard to cover their asses, the Israelis say. As a guess, I think they managed to alter a submarine's operational orders, then forged a letter from her skipper, threatening to fire his missiles. The amazing thing is that the Soviets went for it."
Ritter frowned. "We may have it all backwards, though. All we really know for sure is that somebody, probably the Poles, has played a fantastic dirty trick on the Russians."
"Not us?" Donaldson asked pointedly.
"No, sir, absolutely not. If we tried something like that, even if we succeeded, which isn't likely, they might try the same thing with us. You could start a war that way, and you know the President would never authorize it."
"But someone at the CIA might not care what the President thinks."
"Not in my department. It would be my head. Do you really think we could run an operation like this and then successfully conceal it? Hell, Senator, I wish we could."
"Why the Poles, and why are they able to do it?"
"We've been hearing for some time about a dissident faction inside their intelligence community, one that does not especially love the Soviets. You can pick any number of reasons why. There's the fundamental historical enmity, and the Russians seem to forget that the Poles are Polish first, communists second. My own guess is that it's this business with the Pope, even more than the martial law thing. We know that our old friend Andropov initiated a replay of the Henry II and Becket business. The Pope has given Poland a great deal of prestige, done things for the country that even party members feel good about. Ivan went and spat on their whole country when he did that. You wonder that they're mad. As to their ability, people seem to overlook just what a class act their intelligence service always has been. They're the ones who made the Enigma breakthrough in 1939, not the Brits. They're damned effective, and for the same reason as the Israelis. They have enemies to the east and the west. That sort of thing breeds good agents. We know for certain that they have a lot of people inside Russia, guest workers paying Namanov off for the economic supports given to their country. We also know that a lot of Polish engineers are working in Soviet shipyards. I admit it's funny
Neither country has much of a maritime tradition, but the Poles build lots of Soviet merchant hulls. Their yards are more efficient than the Russian ones, and lately they've been given technical help, mainly in quality control, to the naval building yards.
So the Polish intelligence service has played a trick on the Soviets, Donaldson summarized. Gorshkov is one of the guys who took a hard line on intervention, wasn't he?
True, but he's probably just a target of opportunity. The real aim of this has to be to embarrass Moscow. The fact that this operation attacks the Soviet Navy has no significance in itself. The objective is to raise hell in their senior military channels, and they all come together in Moscow. God, I wish I knew what was really happening. From the 5% we do know, this operation has to be a real masterpiece, the sort of thing legends are made of. We're working on it, trying to find out. So are the Brits and the French and the Israelis. Benny Herzog of the Mossad is supposed to be going ape. The Israelis do pull this kind of trick on their neighbors regularly. They say officially that they don't know anything beyond what they've told us. Maybe so. Or maybe they gave the Poles some technical help. Hard to say. It's certain that the Soviet Navy is a strategic threat to Israel. But we need more time on that. The Israeli connection looks a little too pat at this point.
But you don't know what's happening, just the how and why.
Senator, it's not that easy. Give us some time. At the moment, we may not even want to know. To summarize, somebody has laid a colossal piece of disinformation on the Soviet Navy. It was probably aimed at merely shaking them up, but it has clearly gotten out of hand. How or why it happened, we do not know. You can bet, however, that whoever initiated this operation is working very hard to cover his tracks. Ritter wanted the senator to get this right. If the Soviets find out who did it, their reaction will be nasty. Depend on it. In a few weeks, we might know more. The Israelis owe us for a few things, and eventually they'll let us in on it.
For a couple more F-15s and a company of tanks, Donaldson observed.
Cheap at the price.
But if we're not involved in this, why the secrecy?
You gave me your word, Senator, Ritter reminded him. For one thing, if word leaked out, would the Soviets believe we're not involved?
Not likely.
We're trying to civilize the intelligence game. I mean, we're still enemies, but having the various intelligence services in conflict uses up too many assets, and it's dangerous to both sides. For another, well, if we ever do find out how all this happened, we might just want to make use of it ourselves.
Those reasons are contradictory.
Ritter smiled. The intelligence game is like that. If we find out who did this, we can use that information to our advantage. In any case, Senator, you gave me your word, and I will report that to the President on my return to Langley.
Very well, Donaldson rose. The interview was at an end. I trust you will keep us informed of future developments.
That's what we have to do, sir.
Ritter stood. Indeed. Thank you for coming down. They did not shake hands this time either. Ritter walked into the hall without passing through the anteroom. He stopped to look down into the atrium of the Hart building. It reminded him of the local Hyatt. Uncharacteristically, he took the stairs instead of the elevator down to the first floor. With luck, he had just settled a major score. His car was waiting for him outside, and he told the driver to head to the FBI building.
"Not a CIA operation?" Peter Henderson, the senator's chief aide, asked.
"No, I believe him," Donaldson said. "He's not smart enough to pull something like that."
"I don't know why the president doesn't get rid of him," Henderson commented. "Of course, the kind of person he is, maybe it's better that he's incompetent."
The senator agreed. When he returned to his office, Henderson adjusted the Venetian blinds in his window, though the sun was on the other side of the building. An hour later, the driver of a passing black-and-white taxicab looked up at the window and made a mental note. Henderson worked late that night. The Hart building was nearly empty, with most of the senators out of town. Donaldson was there only because of personal business, and to keep an eye on things. As chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence, he had more duties than he would have liked at this time of year. Henderson took the elevator down to the main lobby. looking every inch the senior congressional aide, a three-piece gray suit, an expensive leather attaché case, his hair just so, and his stride jaunty as he left the building. A black-and-white cab came around the corner and stopped to let out a fare. Henderson got in. "Watergate," he said. Not until the taxi had driven a few blocks did he speak again. Henderson had a modest one-bedroom apartment in the Watergate complex, an irony that he himself had considered many times. When he got to his destination, he did not tip the driver. A woman got in as he walked to the main entrance. Taxis in Washington are very busy in the early evening. "Georgetown University, please," she said, a pretty young woman with auburn hair and an armload of books. "Night school?" the driver asked, checking the mirror. "Exams," the girl said. Her voice was a trace uneasy. "Psych." "Best thing to do with exams is relax," the driver advised. Special Agent Hazel Loomis fumbled with her books. Her purse dropped to the floor. "Oh, damn." She bent over to pick it up, and while doing so, retrieved a miniature tape recorder that another agent had left under the driver's seat. It took 15 minutes to get to the university. The fare was $3.85. Loomis gave the driver a $5 and told him to keep the change. She walked across the campus and entered a Ford, which drove straight to the J. Edgar Hoover building. A lot of work had gone into this, and it had been so easy. "Always is, when the bear walks into your sight." The inspector who had been running the case turned left onto Pennsylvania Avenue. "The problem is finding the damn bear in the first place." The Pentagon. "Gentlemen, you have been asked here because each of you is a career intelligence officer with a working knowledge of submarines and Russian," Davenport said to the four officers seated in his office. "I have need of officers with your qualifications. This is a volunteer assignment. It could involve a considerable element of danger. We cannot be sure at this point. The only other thing I can say is that this will be a dream job for an intelligence officer, but the sort of dream that you'll never be able to tell anyone about. We're all used to that, aren't we?" Davenport ventured a rare smile. "As they say in the movies, if you want in, fine. If not, you may leave at this point, and nothing will ever be said. It is asking a lot to expect men to walk into a potentially dangerous assignment blindfolded." Of course, nobody left. The men who had been called here were not quitters. Besides, something would be said, and Davenport had a good memory. These were professional officers. One of the compensations for wearing a uniform and earning less money than an equally talented man could make in the real world is the off chance of being killed. "Thank you, gentlemen. I think you will find this worth your while." Davenport stood and handed each man a manila envelope. "You will soon have the chance to examine a Soviet missile submarine from the inside." Four pairs of eyes blinked in unison. 33 North, 75 West. The USS Ethan Allen had been on station now for more than 30 hours. She was cruising in a 5-mile circle at a depth of 200 feet. There was no hurry. The submarine was making just enough speed to maintain steerage way, her reactor producing only 10% of rated power. The chief quartermaster was assisting in the galley. "First time I've ever done this in a sub," one of the Allen's officers, who was acting as ship's cook, noted, stirring an omelet. The quartermaster sighed imperceptibly. They ought to have sailed with a proper cook, but theirs had been a kid, and every enlisted man aboard now had over 20 years of service. The chiefs were all technicians, except the quartermaster, who could handle a toaster on a good day. "You cook much at home, sir?" "Some. My parents used to have a restaurant down at Pass Christian. This is my mama's special Cajun omelet. Shame we don't have any bass. I can do some nice things with bass and a little lemon." "You fish much, chief?" "No, sir." The small complement of officers and senior chiefs were working in an informal atmosphere, and the quartermaster was a man accustomed to discipline and status boundaries. "Commander, can I ask what the hell we're doing?"
Wish I knew, Chief. Mostly, we're waiting for something.
But what, sir?
Damned if I know. You want to hand me those ham cubes? And could you check the bread in the oven? Ought to be about done.
The New Jersey. Commodore Eaton was perplexed. His battle group was holding 20 miles south of the Russians. If it hadn't been dark, he could have seen the Kirov's towering superstructure on the horizon from his perch on the flag bridge. Her escorts were in a single broad line ahead of the battlecruiser, pinging away in the search for a submarine. Since the Air Force had staged its mock attack, the Soviets had been acting like sheep. This was out of character, to say the least. The New Jersey and her escorts were keeping the Russian formation under constant observation, and a pair of sentry aircraft were watching for good measure. The Russian redeployment had switched Eaton's responsibility to the Kirov group. This suited him. His main battery turrets were trained in, but the guns were loaded with 8-inch guided rounds, and the fire control stations were fully manned. The Chihuahua was 30 miles south, her armed strike force of Harriers sitting ready to move at 5-minute notice. The Soviets had to know this, even though their ASW helicopters had not come within 5 miles of an American ship for 2 days. The Bear and Backfire bombers, which were passing overhead in shuttle rounds to Cuba, only a few, and those returning to Russia as quickly as they could be turned around, could not fail to report what they saw. The American vessels were in extended attack formation. The missiles on the New Jersey and her escorts being fed continuous information from the ship's sensors, and the Russians were ignoring them. Their only electronic emissions were routine navigation radars. Strange. The Nimitz was now within air range after a 5,000-mile dash from the South Atlantic. The carrier and her nuclear-powered escorts, the California, Bainbridge, and Truxton, were now only 400 miles to the south, and the America battle group half a day behind them. The Kennedy was 500 miles to the east. The Soviets would have to consider the danger of 3 carrier air wings at their backs and hundreds of land-based Air Force birds gradually shifting south from one base to another. Perhaps this explained their docility. The Backfire bombers were being escorted in relays all the way from Iceland, first by Navy Tomcats from the Saratoga's air wing, then by Air Force Phantoms operating in Maine, which handed the Soviet aircraft off to Eagles and Fighting Falcons as they worked down the coast almost as far south as Cuba. There was not much doubt how seriously the United States was taking this, though American units were no longer actively harassing the Russians. Eaton was glad they weren't. There was nothing more to be gained from harassment, and anyway, if it had to, his battle group could switch from a peace to a war footing in about 2 minutes.
"Excuse me, I just moved in down the hall, and my phone isn't hooked up yet. Would you mind if I made a call?"
Henderson arrived at that decision quickly enough. 5'3" or so, auburn hair, gray eyes, adequate figure, a dazzling smile, and fashionably dressed.
"Sure. Welcome to the Watergate. Come on in."
"Thank you. I'm Hazel Loomis. My friends call me Sissy."
She held out her hand.
"Pete Henderson. The phone's in the kitchen. I'll show you."
Things were looking up. He'd just ended a lengthy relationship with one of the senator's secretaries. It had been hard on both of them.
"I'm not disturbing anything, am I? You don't have anyone here, do you?"
"No, just me and the TV. Are you new to D.C.? The nightlife isn't all it's cracked up to be. At least, not when you have to go to work the next day.
Who do you work for?
I take it you're single?"
"That's right. I work for DARPA, as a computer programmer. I'm afraid I can't talk about it very much."
All sorts of good news, Henderson thought. "Here's the phone." Loomis looked around quickly, as though evaluating the job the decorator had done. She reached into her purse and took out a dime, handing it to Henderson. He laughed. "First call is free. And believe me, you can use my phone whenever you want."
"I just knew," she said, punching the buttons, "that this would be nicer than living in Laurel. Hello, Kathy?
Sissy.
I just got moved in. Haven't even got my phone hooked up yet. Oh, a guy down the hall. He was kind enough to let me use his phone."
"Okay. See you tomorrow for lunch. Bye, Kathy."
Loomis looked around.
Who decorated for you?
Did it myself. I minored in art at Harvard, and I know some nice shops in Georgetown. You can find some good bargains if you know where to look.
Oh, I'd just love to have my place look like this. Could you show me around?
Sure. The bedroom first. Henderson laughed to show that he had no untoward intentions, which of course he did, though he was a patient man in such matters. The tour, which lasted several minutes, assured Loomis that the apartment was indeed empty. A minute later, there was a knock at the door. Henderson grumbled good-naturedly as he went to answer it.
"Pete Henderson?"
The man asking the question was dressed in a business suit. Henderson had on jeans and a sports shirt.
"Yes?"
Henderson backed up, knowing what this had to be. What came next, though, surprised him.
"You're under arrest, Mr. Henderson," Sissy Loomis said, holding up her ID card. "The charge is espionage. You have the rights to remain silent. You have the right to speak with an attorney. If you give up the right to remain silent, everything you say will be recorded and may be used against you. If you do not have an attorney or cannot afford one, we will see to it that an attorney is appointed to represent you. Do you understand these rights, Mr. Henderson?" It was Sissy Loomis's first espionage case. For 5 years, she had specialized in bank robberies takeouts, often working as a teller with a .357 Magnum revolver in her cash drawer. "Do you wish to waive these rights?"
"No, I do not." Henderson's voice was raspy. "Oh, you will," the inspector observed. "You will."
He turned to the three agents who had accompanied him.
"Take this place apart. Neatly, gentlemen, and quietly. We don't want to wake anyone. You, Mr. Henderson, will come with us. You can change first. We can do this the easy way or the hard way. If you promise to cooperate, no cuffs. But if you try to run, you don't want to do that, believe me."
The inspector had been in the FBI for 20 years and had never even drawn his service revolver in anger, while Loomis had already shot and killed 2 men. He was old-time FBI and couldn't help but wonder what Mr. Hoover would think of that, not to mention the new Jewish director. The Red October. Ramius and Kamarov conferred over the chart for several minutes, tracing alternate course tracks before agreeing on one. The enlisted men ignored this. They had never been encouraged to know about charts. The captain walked to the aft bulkhead and lifted the phone.
"Comrade Melikin," he ordered, waiting a few seconds. "Comrade, this is the captain. Any further difficulties with the reactor systems?"
"No, comrade captain."
"Excellent. Hold things together another 2 days."
Ramius hung up. It was 30 minutes to the turn of the next watch. Melikin and Kirill Sertsboy, the assistant engineer, had the duty in the engine room. Melikin monitored the turbines, and Sertsboy handled the reactor systems. Each had a Mishman and 3 enlisted men in attendance. The engineers had had a very busy cruise. Every gauge and monitor in the engine spaces, it seemed, had been inspected, and many had been entirely rebuilt by the 2 senior officers, who had been helped by Valentin Bugayev, the electronics officer and onboard genius, who was also handling the political awareness classes for the crewmen. The engine room crewmen were the most rattled on the vessel. The supposed contamination was common knowledge. There are no long-lived secrets on a submarine. To ease their load, ordinary seamen were supplementing the engine watches. The captain called this a good chance for the cross-training he believed in. The crew thought it was a good way to get poisoned. Discipline was being maintained, of course. This was owing partly to the trust the men had in their commanding officer, partly to their training, but mostly to their knowledge of what would happen if they failed to carry out their orders immediately and enthusiastically.
"Comrade Melikin," Sertsboy called, "I am showing pressure fluctuation on the main loop, number 6 gauge.
"Coming,"
Melikin hurried over and shoved the Mishman out of the way when he got to the master control panel.
"More bad instruments. The others show normal. Nothing important,"
the chief engineer said blandly, making sure everyone could hear. The whole compartment watch saw the chief engineer whisper something to his assistant. The younger one shook his head slowly,
while two sets of hands worked the controls. A loud two-phase buzzer and a rotating red alarm light went off.
"Scream the bell!" Melikin ordered. "Screaming!"
Sertzboy stabbed his finger on the master shutdown button.
"You men, get forward!"
Melikin ordered next. There was no hesitation.
"No, you! Connect battery power to the Caterpillar motors, quickly!"
The warrant officer raced back to throw the proper switches, cursing his change of orders. It took 40 seconds.
"Done, comrade!" "Go!"
The warrant officer was the last man out of the compartment. He made certain that the hatches were dogged down tight before running to the control room.
"What is the problem?" Romeus asked calmly.
"Radiation alarm in the heat exchange room."
"Very well. Go forward and shower with the rest of your watch. Get control of yourself."
Romeus patted the Mishman on the arm.
"We have had these problems before. You are a trained man. The crewmen look to you for leadership."
Romeus lifted the phone. It was a moment before the other end was picked up.
"What has happened, comrade?"
The control room crew watched their captain listen to the answer. They could not help but admire his calm. Radiation alarms had sounded throughout the hull.
"Very well. We do not have too many hours of battery power left, comrade. We must go to snorkeling depth. Stand by to activate the diesel."
"Yes."
He hung up. "Comrades, you will listen to me." Romeus's voice was under total control. "There has been a minor failure in the reactor control systems. The alarm you heard was not a major radiation leak, but rather a failure of the reactor rod control systems. Comrades Melikin and Sertzboy successfully executed an emergency reactor shutdown, but we cannot operate the reactor properly without the primary controls. We will, therefore, complete our cruise on diesel power. To ensure against any possible radiation contamination, the reactor spaces have been isolated, and all compartments, engineering spaces first, will be vented with surface air when we snorkel. Komarov, you will go aft to work the environmental controls. I will take the con."
"Aye, comrade captain."
Komarov went aft. Romeus lifted the microphone to give this news to the crew. Everyone was waiting for something. Forward, some crewmen muttered among themselves that "minor" was a word suffering from overuse. The nuclear submarines did not run on diesel and ventilate with surface air for the hell of it. Finished with his terse announcement, Romeus ordered the submarine to approach the surface. The Dallas.
"Beats me, skipper." Jones shook his head. "Reactor noises have stopped. Pumps are cut way back. But he's running at the same speed, just like before. On battery, I guess."
"Must be a hell of a battery system to drive something that big this fast," Mancuso observed.
"I did some computations on that a few hours ago." Jones held up his pad. "This is based on the Typhoon hull, with a nice slick hull coefficient, so it's probably conservative."
"Where'd you learn to do this, Jonesy?"
"Mr. Thompson looked up the hydrodynamic stuff for me. The electrical end is fairly simple. He might have something exotic, fuel cells maybe. If not, if he's running ordinary batteries, he has enough raw electrical power to crank every car in L.A.
Mancuso shook his head. "Can't last forever."
Jones held up his hand. "Hull creaking. Sounds like he's going up some."
The Red October.
"Raise snorkel," Romeus said.
Looking through the periscope, he verified that the snorkel was up.
"Well, no other ships in view. That is good news. I think we have lost our imperialist hunters. Raise the ESM antenna. Let's be sure no enemy aircraft are lurking about with their radars."
"Clear, comrade captain."
Bugayev was manning the ESM board.
"Nothing at all. Not even airliner sets."
"So, we have indeed lost our ratpack."
Romeus lifted the phone again.
"Melikin, you may open the main induction and vent the engine spaces. Then start the diesel."
A minute later, everyone aboard felt the vibration as the October's massive diesel engine cranked on battery power. This sucked up all the air from the reactor spaces, replacing it with air drawn through the snorkel
and ejecting the contaminated air into the sea. The engine continued to crank for 2 minutes, and throughout the hull, men waited for the rumble that would mean the engine had caught and could generate power to run the electric motors. It didn't catch. After another 30 seconds, the cranking stopped. The control room phone buzzed. Ramius lifted it.
"What is wrong with the diesel, Comrade Chief Engineer?"
the captain asked sharply.
"I see. I'll send the men back."
"Oh, stand by." Ramius looked around, his mouth a thin, bloodless line. The junior engineering officer, Sviadov, was standing at the back of the compartment.
"I need the man who knows diesel engines to help Comrade Melikin."
"I grew up on a state farm," Bugayev said. "I started playing with tractor engines as a boy."
"There is an additional problem."
Bugayev nodded knowingly.
"So I gather. Comrade Captain, but we need the diesel, do we not?"
"I will not forget this, comrade," Ramius said quietly.
"Then you can buy me some rum in Cuba, comrade."
Bugayev smiled courageously.
"I wish to meet a Cuban comrade, preferably one with long hair." "May I accompany you, comrade?"
Sviadov asked anxiously. He had just been going on watch, approaching the reactor room hatch, when he'd been knocked aside by escaping crewmen.
"Let us assess the nature of the problem first," Bugayev said, looking at Ramius for confirmation.
"Yes, there is plenty of time. Bugayev, report to me yourself in 10 minutes.
"Aye, aye, Comrade Captain."
"Sviadov, take charge of the lieutenant's station."
Ramius pointed to the ESM board.
"Use the opportunity to learn some new skills."
The lieutenant did as he was ordered. The captain seemed very preoccupied. Sviadov had never seen him like this before.
The 14th day. Thursday, 16th December. A super stallion. They were traveling at 150 knots, 2,000 feet over the darkened sea. The Super Stallion helicopter was old, built towards the end of the Vietnam War. She had first seen service clearing mines off Haiphong Harbor. That had been her primary duty, pulling a sea sled and acting as a flying minesweeper. Now, the big Sikorsky was used for other purposes, mainly long-range heavy-lift missions. The three turbine engines perched atop the fuselage packed a considerable amount of power and could carry a platoon of armed combat troops a great distance. Tonight, in addition to her normal flight crew of three, she was carrying 4 passengers and a heavy load of fuel in the outrigger tanks. The passengers were clustered in the aft corner of the cargo area, chatting among themselves, or trying to, over the racket of the engines. Their conversation was animated. The intelligence officers had dismissed the danger implicit in their mission. No sense dwelling on that, and they were speculating on what they might find aboard an honest-to-God Russian submarine. Each man considered the stories that would result, and decided it was a shame that they would never be able to tell them. None voiced this thought, however. At most, a handful of people would ever know the entire story. The others would only see disjointed fragments that later might be thought parts of any number of other operations. Any Soviet agent trying to determine what this mission had been would find himself in a maze with dozens of blank walls. The mission profile was a tight one. The helicopter was flying on a specific track to HMS Invincible, from which they would fly to the USS Pigeon aboard a Royal Navy Sea King. The Stallion's disappearance from Oceania Naval Air Station for only a few hours would be viewed merely as a matter of routine. The helicopter's turboshaft engines, running at maximum cruising power, were gulping down fuel. The aircraft was now 400 miles off the U.S. coast and had another 80 miles to go. Their flight to the Invincible was not direct. It was a dogleg course intended to fool whoever might have noticed their departure on radar. The pilots were tired. 4 hours is a long time to sit in a cramped cockpit, and military aircraft are not known for their creature comforts. The flight instruments glowed a dull red.
both men were especially careful to watch their artificial horizon. A solid overcast denied them a fixed reference point aloft, and flying over water at night was mesmerizing. It was by no means an unusual mission, however. The pilots had done this many times, and their concern was not unlike that of an experienced driver on a slick road. The dangers were real, but routine.
"Juliet 6, your target is bearing 080, range 75 miles," the sentry called in.
"Thanks for lost," Commander John Marks wondered over the intercom.
"Air Force," his co-pilot replied. "They don't know much about flying over water. They think you get lost without roads to follow."
"Uh-huh," Marks chuckled. "Who do you like in the Eagles game tonight?"
"Oilers by 3.5.
6.5. Philly's fullback is still hurt.
5.
"Okay, $5. I'll go easy on you," Marks grinned. He loved to gamble.
The day after Argentina had attacked the Falklands, he asked if anyone in the squadron wanted to take Argentina and 7 points. A few feet above their heads and a few feet aft, the engines were racing at thousands of RPM, turning gears to drive the 7-bladed main rotor. They had no way of knowing that a fracture was developing in the transmission casing near the fluid test port.
"Juliet 6, your target has just launched a fighter to escort you in. We'll rendezvous in 8 minutes. Approaching you at 11 o'clock. Angels 3.
"Nice of them," Mark said.
Harrier 2-0. Lieutenant Parker was flying the Harrier that would escort the Super Stallion. A sub-lieutenant sat in the back seat of the Royal Navy aircraft. Its purpose was not actually to escort the chopper to the Invincible. It was to make a last check for any Soviet submarines that might notice the Super Stallion in flight and wonder what it was doing.
"Any activity on the water?" Parker asked.
"Not a glimmer."
The sub-lieutenant was working the FLIR package, which was sweeping left and right over their course track. Neither man knew what was going on, though both had speculated at length, incorrectly, on what it was that was chasing their carrier all over the bloody ocean.
"Try looking for the helicopter," Parker said.
"One moment.
There. Just south of our track."
The sub-lieutenant pressed a button, and the display came up on the pilot's screen. The thermal image was mainly of the engines clustered atop the aircraft inside the fainter, dull green glow of the hot rotor tips.
"Harrier 2-0, this is Sentry Echo. Your target is at your 1 o'clock, distance 20 miles. Over."
"Roger. We have him on our IR box. Thank you. Out," Parker said.
"Bloody useful things, those sentries.
The Sikorsky's running for all she's worth.
Look at that engine signature."
The Super Stallion. At this moment, the transmission casing fractured. Instantly, the gallons of lubricating oil became a greasy cloud behind the rotor hub, and the delicate gears began to tear at one another. An alarm light flashed on the control panel. Marks and the co-pilot instantly reached down to cut power to all 3 engines. There was not enough time. The transmission tried to freeze, but the power of the 3 engines tore it apart. What happened was the next thing to an explosion. Jagged pieces burst through the safety housing and ripped the forward part of the aircraft. The rotor's momentum twisted the Stallion savagely around, and it dropped rapidly. 2 of the men in the back, who had loosened their seatbelts, jerked out of their seats and rolled forward.
"Mayday, mayday, mayday, this is Juliet 6, the co-pilot called.
Commander Marks's body was slumped over the controls, a dark stain on the back of his neck.
"We're going in, we're going in! Mayday, mayday, mayday!"
The co-pilot was trying to do something. The main rotor was windmilling slowly, too slowly. The automatic decoupler that was supposed to allow it to auto-rotate and give him a vestige of control had failed. His controls were nearly useless, and he was riding the point of a blunt lance towards a black ocean. It was 20 seconds before they hit. He fought with his airfoil controls and tail rotor in order to jerk the aircraft around. He succeeded, but it was too late. Harrier 2-0. It was not the first time Parker had seen men die. He had taken a life himself after sending a Sidewinder missile up the tailpipe of an Argentine Dagger fighter. That had not been pleasant, this was worse. As he watched, the Superstallion's humpbacked engine cluster blew apart in a shower of sparks. There was no fire as such, for what good it did them. He watched and tried to will the nose to come up, and it did, but not enough. The Stallion hit the water hard. The fuselage snapped apart in the middle. The front end sank in an instant, but the after part wallowed for a few seconds like a bathtub before beginning to fill with water. According to the picture supplied by the FLIR package, no one got clear before it sank.
Sentry, sentry, did you see that? Over!
Roger that, Harrier. We're calling an SAR mission right now. Can you orbit?
Roger, we can loiter here.
Parker checked his fuel.
90 minutes. Aye, stand by.
Parker nosed his fighter down and flicked on his landing lights. This lit up the low-light TV system.
Did you see that, Ian?
He asked his backseater.
I think it moved. Sentry, sentry, we have a possible survivor in the water. Tell Invincible to get a Sea King down here straight away. I'm going down to investigate. We'll advise.
Roger that. Harrier 2-0, your captain reports a hello spooling up right now. Out. The Royal Navy Sea King was there in 25 minutes. A rubber-suited paramedic jumped in the water to get a collar on the one survivor. There were no others, and no wreckage, only a slick of jet fuel evaporating slowly into the cold air. A second helicopter continued the search as the first raced back to the carrier. The HMS Invincible. Ryan watched from the bridge as the medics carried the stretcher into the island. Another crewman appeared a moment later with a briefcase.
He had this, sir. He's a lieutenant commander, name of Dwyer. One leg and several ribs broken.
He's in a bad way, Admiral.
Thank you. White took the case. Any possibility of other survivors?
The sailor shook his head.
Not a good one, sir. The Sikorsky must have sunk like a stone.
He looked at Ryan.
Sorry, sir.
Ryan nodded. Thanks.
Norfolk on the radio, Admiral, a communications officer said. Let's go, Jack.
Admiral White handed him the briefcase and led him to the communications room.
The chopper went in. We have one survivor being worked on right now, Ryan said over the radio.
It was silent for a moment.
Who is it?
Name's Dwyer. They took him right to sickbay, Admiral. He's out of action. Tell Washington, whatever this operation is supposed to be, we have to rethink it.
Roger. Out,
Admiral Blackburn said.
Whatever we decide to do, Admiral White observed, it will have to be fast. We must get our Hello off to the Pigeon in 2 hours to have her back before dawn.
Ryan knew exactly what that would mean. There were only 4 men at sea who both knew what was going on and were close enough to do anything. He was the only American among them. The Kennedy was too far away. The Nimitz was close enough, but using her would mean getting the data to her by radio, and Washington was not enthusiastic about that. The only other alternative was to assemble and dispatch another intelligence team. There just wasn't enough time.
Let's get this case open, Admiral. I need to see what this plan is.
They picked up a machinist's mate on the way to White's cabin. He proved to be an excellent locksmith.
Dear God, Ryan breathed, reading the contents of the case. You better see this.
Well, White said a few minutes later.
That is clever.
It's cute, all right, Ryan said. I wonder what genius thought it up. I know I'm going to be stuck with this. I'll ask Washington for permission to take a few officers along with me. 10 minutes later, they were back in communications. White had the compartment cleared. Then Jack spoke over the encrypted voice channel. Both hoped the scrambling device worked.
I hear you fine, Mr. President. You know what happened to the helicopter?
Yes, Jack, most unfortunate. I need you to pinch hit for us.
Yes, sir, I anticipated that. I can't order you, but you know what the stakes are. Will you do it?
Ryan closed his eyes.
Affirmative. I appreciate it, Jack.
Sure you do.
Sir, I need your authorization to take some help with me. A few British officers.
One, the president said.
Sir, I need more than that.
One.
Understood, sir. We'll be moving in an hour.
You know what's supposed to happen.
Yes, sir. The survivor had the ops orders with him. I've already read them over.
Good luck.